my understanding that it doesn't, if you have a detached structure, like a really, you've got a older house and you put a fancy new big accessory dwelling unit there, that could add more than 75% of the value of the current structures on the property, but it's a detached structure. Is there any circumstance in which that would trigger having to make, add sprinklers or do a new roof on the main house?
So detached structures, according to the code, already require that anything over 120 square feet is required to be compliant with the WUI code, detached structure. That 75% is for remodels of existing structures. So does that answer your question?
So the answer you're confirming is essentially no, that there's that no matter how fancy the ADU is, you don't have to do anything to upgrade the main house, but the ADU has to be compliant with the standards.
That's correct.
Okay. Great, thank you. I just wanted to be clear for everybody on that. Then coming back to the list, could you put up the list that you showed us of the, yeah, there we go. So one, because part of the discussion we had earlier at council was what's, you know, the, do we really have to require everything, homes that are being built or majorly renovated in the moderate fire risks area to meet every single one of these new WUI requirements. And I appreciate staff coming back with a judicious list that includes only three of these. And two of them, the exterior garage doors and the vents are probably not all that costly relative to some of the other ones. The Class A roof would be the exception to that, potentially. So just can you elaborate a little bit more on how it is that having a Class A roof on a structure helps the fire department fight the fire in the community?
So the difference between a Class A and a Class B roof is the fire, the hours of fire resistance. So a Class A roof has a 2-hour fire resistant, and the material underneath the shingles or the tile or whatever also has a fire resistant barrier. A Class B roof only has a 1-hour fire resistance, and they're not required to have that underneath layer of fire resistant material. So it gives the fire department more time to get ahead of that ember casting, to do patrols in that area, in those areas that these embers are casting, to see if there are embers on the roof, to knock those down or to get rid of little small spot fires. So it gives them a little bit more time rather than 1 hour of that ember sitting on that roof, igniting through the material and then starting the attic on fire. And once the attic's on fire, that structure is a total loss. So giving them an actual extra hour in a significant event with significant ember casting is the reason for the recommendation.
Okay, so basically it gives you a much better chance of catching an ember and dousing an ember that gets onto that roof before it catches that structure on fire, burns it down, and turns it into a torch that cast embers all over the rest of the community.
Yeah, that's correct. And that has to be consistent with the venting as well. If you had a Class A roof, but you didn't have the proper venting, those embers are going to get in that attic anyway. So that's why we kind of combine the two together to have the venting to prevent the embers entering into the attic and the Class A roof to prevent the embers catching that roof on fire and getting into the attic.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. And then one more thing, there's language that we find on pages 68 and 69 in there about mulch. And I want to thank the fire marshal for coming out and doing a fire inspection on the property that my husband and I own and live in. And want to remind the community that anybody can request that, right? you know, anywhere in the community. And it was really valuable. And one of the things I learned is, like, the single cheapest thing I can do to reduce fire risk on my at my own house is to rake back the mulch that is that we put on to improve the drought tolerance. So rake it back 5 feet from the house so we don't have mulch next to the house that can light other things on fire. And I just wanted to make sure that there's some language there that mulching for new landscaping, that mulching is required, but that there's an exception for it. And want to confirm that there is an exception, so you don't, you're not caught in this thing where you have to put mulch next to the house that really is not a good idea for fire reasons. Can we? Does this meet that exception?
Yeah, so I believe you're referring to a section of the building code that talks about landscaping that Bruce is going to address.
Ah.
But it does so. This code here did adopt the zero zone, the 0 to 5 foot zone. So any new structures being built are going to be required to have that zero zone of hardscaping or non-flammable material from the edge of any portion of that structure to 5 feet out. So even if the building code says you have to do some sort of landscaping or some sort of mulch activity, they still have to abide by the WUI code saying that they cannot do that in that 0 to 5 foot zone.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Newsom.
Thank you. Originally, when we discussed the WUI, we were told it was state mandated that we had to adopt the WUI. But here on page 24, it says our current section 101 allows any additions or alterations to be made without the existing building and complying with the special building construction regulations. Are we required to add the WUI into all existing?
So from my understanding, this code was adopted by the state back in 2025. And if we adopt it or not, the city is still required to follow the requirements within the code. By adopting it, we were able to make our own local amendments to that code.
So the local amendments that we're making in here would then place a little bit more financial burden on those property changes that currently are exempt from that, correct?
Yes. It would be for the additions and modifications, and then to those three sections we pointed out for the moderate fire severity zone.
So as a city, we don't have to make this local amendment for those existing.
That's correct. They're proposed amendments that it's up to the council if they would like to adopt them or not.
Okay. And then do we currently have any permits on file that are going to be affected by any of the changes that are made tonight?
I believe all the permits that have been issued since 2026 already follow the current WUI code that was adopted by the state. It would not affect the local amendments, if I'm correct with that.
So right now there's no one that's undergoing existing building or structures that are more 50% or 75% or value?
I'll let Bruce answer that question.
Sorry, I like to ask the technical ones.
Thank you for your question, council member. So currently right now, these provisions, as Mr. Van Sun had mentioned earlier, would apply to anybody that applied for any alterations, modifications, or additions after January 1st of this year. Currently, right now, under the 50% or the 75% rule for the particular structure, we would typically meet with them to discuss, to get provide the valuation information or to receive the information to overlook it. And as of right now, neither of those two situations have existed after the first of the year.
Okay. So if we don't make these changes, or if we make these changes, it's not affecting anybody that's currently sitting in with permits. Thank you.
Oops. Oh, go ahead.
Thank you, Mayor. Just for clarification for anybody that might be listening tonight, I started to understand your question a little bit different. Councilmember Newsom's question a little bit different. If somebody has a house in a high fire severity zone that is wood siding, Class B roof, I mean, basically a rating to catch on fire at any moment, with this, with, what was it? Never mind. These new amendments, they're not, these people are not required to now bring their house up to code just because, only if they pull a permit, is that correct?
That's correct, only for additions or modifications or new construction.
Okay, I just want to make that clear, that people aren't sitting at home thinking, oh my God, I know my house is, doesn't comply with any of that stuff, and now with this thing that we're about to adopt, they're going to have to spend thousands of dollars to bring their house up to code. And I know that's not true, but I just wanted to hear them, have them hear it from you. Appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And so I'm concerned, though, about the question and answers earlier regarding using the example of a colony home. So, you know, somebody's got a 1,500 square foot older home. You know, they want to add a fair amount. Or let's say a home burns down. And obviously now the replacement work is going to be more than 75% of the replacement value. And with these requirements, it'll be well over 100% of the replacement value. But we're going to make somebody, you know, potentially tear up the siding on their existing house because they want to do an addition. And that's part of the state requirement, though. That's not under our discretionary modifications, correct?
No, that is a local amendment that we're requesting to adopt.
Okay, because I mean that does cause me some concern that we're going to tell somebody with an older home that essentially, well, scrap your remodel plans because you just triggered this, and we're going to make you know retrofit the entire house. And I understand that maybe from a fire perspective, half a house isn't much better than no house. Is that what you're kind of indicating? That, you know, if one side of my house is up, you know, 2026 standards, but the other side of my house is, you know, 1968 standards, that it's really not much protection? Is that your perspective?
Yeah. Unfortunately, if the half that's not up to standards catches on fire, the whole house will end up burning down.
Right. Well, and if the half that's not protected is the one that's exposed to the, you know, neighborhood fire,
correct.
I guess the same, you know, logic would apply. Okay, I guess, you know, if we're going to require it, I guess we have to do that. But it certainly is going to affect, I mean, some people's plans are just going to be out the window because this requirement would render their desire to expand essentially unaffordable. Or they'll have to shrink their expansion to below 50%. You had a follow-on?
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that. What's being proposed, as it was already stated, has kind of been in effect for years anyway. If somebody wanted to do an addition to their house, and it was a certain size, and I don't remember all the numbers and everything, but you know, you'd have to, based on the size, you might have to add fire sprinklers to just the addition. But if it goes over a certain size and you have to do the entire house, and these are the kind of things that just homeowners have to look into, and it becomes part of the construction cost, as far as I'm concerned. So then you can base your size of your addition on that. And if you know it ahead of time, then it's, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want to blindside somebody with it, but my feeling is I'm okay with all these changes because I think it makes it safer. And it's sort of something that we've already been doing anyway. So,
okay. Thank you for that. In follow on to Councilmember Funk's questions regarding the roof, the roofing requirements that we're looking to impose on the yellow areas of the map. And like her, I'm glad we didn't impose all of these because I know from personal experience that some of these things, you know, underfloor and eave protection, all this kind of stuff. I mean, my 1,000 square foot ADU cost more to build than our 2,300 square foot house because mostly because of, you know, WUI fire code requirements. So I'm glad that we aren't requiring all of this in the yellow zone. But in terms of the roof, You said something that I perhaps didn't realize. Well, a couple things. One is I picture an ash, you know, or an ember landing on my tile roof. How is that going to catch my tile roof on fire? How am I feeling unrealistically secure with my tile roof?
No, your tile roof actually meets the current code standards.
Okay, well, I understand it's class A, but I mean, it's okay, and you list these different materials here, and it made me wonder. The question for Bruce is that I assume that in this day and age, even in our yellow and even the white zone, you know, on our map here, most people are putting a Class A material roof on anyway, right?
Thank you for the question, Mayor. Yes, that'd be correct. To give you an example to go along with what you're asking, photovoltaic, which we'll talk about here soon, or solar systems on houses, right? They require a certain level of protection or fire protection. So if you have a Class B roof and you add a Class A photovoltaic system on the roof, that would work. You're co-compliant. But if you had a Class A roof and you went to add a Class B rated photovoltaic system on, that would not work. So typically speaking, as you could say right now, to go along with what you're asking, most of the photovoltaic systems, there's certain UL listings that have already Class A rating. The structure of the PV system is Class A. So most likely for all new structures, the roofing to support the energy code and the requirements for photovoltaic, they're getting Class A roofs installed already for new structures.
What is a non-Class A roofing material?
Well, like Mr. Van Sunde mentioned earlier, so you have A, B, and C, and it's just a less of a rating. So wood shake would be considered a non-Class A.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's wood shake, is just call it kindling. I mean.
Yeah. Yes, I agree 100%.
Okay. Which is funny because, I mean, where I grew up in Modesto, everybody had a wood shake roof. Now, okay, but the reason I'm asking that is I don't see in this case that we're really imposing an additional expense, although Chief Ansan, I was surprised to hear about the underlayment needing to be fireproof. But if you have the Class A material in the terms of the roof, like a tile roof, concrete tile, whatever, that's not going to burn in and of itself. Do you need that fireproof underlayment or fire-rated underlayment?
I believe, Mr. St. John could correct me, but I believe that material is included in the whole Class A portion of a roof construction, would be that underlayment.
Okay, because I mean, like I said, I'm not picturing the necessity of the underlayment if you got a tile or non-flammable roofing material. And I'm only looking out for the people in this yellow zone because we're making a discretionary, we're talking about taking a discretionary action here that's going to impose costs on people. So I want to, you know, I don't want to get super technical, but I want to ensure that we are, you know, cognizant of that additional cost, if there is one. So I'm going to let him answer. Go ahead, answer.
Yeah, so for a good example, Mayor, a Class A tile roof, for example, you would have the tile roof, then you had wooden slats that create the pitch, right? But below that, you would have the underlayment, which would be part of the listing of the Class A, which would be typically two layers of a certain type of building paper. Now, you would have combustible materials between the two, but because of the overlayment of the tile and the paper below, it would create the listing for a Class A, where asphalt shingles, for example, would sit right on top of the underlayment paper. So the asphalt shingle becomes the majority of the listing for the Class A roof, and it doesn't take really any consideration the paper.
Okay. All right, thank you. You had a follow-on question?
Yes. Sorry. Yeah, I want to follow on that. So what I'm trying to get clear is, if you already have a roof that's made out of tile or asphalt or something that's not combustible, and you're in the yellow areas of moderate fire risk, or would we be requiring you, if a new addition is of a certain value, to rip off that roof and put something underneath it and then put it back? Or would something that's made with tile or asphalt shingles or other non-combustible materials already be made with the underlays that make it a Class A roof?
Thank you for the question, Council Member. I would love to speak on the behalf of most manufacturers and roofing contractors, but the majority of the roofs that we do see here within the city limits are typically already Class A. So there would be, if you had a structure that was doing a re-roof on a partial or doing an addition, they usually would match the same materials for the addition with the same materials that were on the structure, or they would just re-roof the whole structure, because you wouldn't typically have somebody that had a 30-year-old roof on one portion and they do an addition with a brand new roof. They would remove, which we see a lot, and they would install an all new roof for the whole structure.
Okay, go ahead.
We're going to have follow up after follow up. So again, I'm just trying to, I want to make this feel easy for the people listening. Good question on the roofing thing. But if somebody's going to re-roof their house, you know, they got 30-year-old roof, asphalt shingles, it's ready to go, and can put something new on it. This isn't more of a burden for them, because what they're going to put on is already compliant with what we're doing. So we're not asking them to do anything more than what's already would have been required anyway. Is that correct?
Thank you, council member. Yes, that'd be correct. I would say it'd be industry standard.
Industry standard. That's good. Okay, thank you.
Okay, back to my. Oh, you have a follow up now?
Yeah. It's what everybody's doing. So figured.
Go for it.
So 75% of replacement costs. Two questions. Who determines that? Do you contact our insurance company? Do you have an appraiser go out there or a general contractor? And it says or, so do we get to decide which of those, either 75% replacement cost or 50% or more on the size of the addition? Because I can remodel a little more than 50% of my house for less than 75% of the replacement value. So if I go by the second, then
I believe the 50% is with additions and the 75% is for alterations. So that means not adding an addition to the house. So if you take an existing structure and strip it down to the studs, and the value of that remodel is more than 75% of the replacement value of the home, then that will trigger it. Or if you're doing an addition, it's not and or, it's they're two separate things. One's for the addition and one's for the alteration. So the 50% is for the addition. The 75% is for the alteration.
Okay, I would make that more clear. I don't know if I'm the only one that thought it was or in the same. I could be just, you know, I'm not 100%. I get fire safety, but the cost of building now and the cost of remodeling your house now is crazy. I mean, a kitchen is like $60,000. For a full remodel with, you know, top of line and everything, maybe even more. I could see, you know, a small house, if someone's buying a fixer upper, that's a smaller house, like 1500 square feet or less. A good remodel could easily be 75% of the replacement value if the house is a piece of crap when you buy it. I'm just kind of concerned with adding so much more cost. If you're doubling the size of your home, I don't know. I see the fire safety aspect of it, but it's so expensive to do any construction in California as it is. And this is just going to make people either not buy a house and increase the property tax by increasing the value of the property.
I think we're getting into commentary, so let's save that those
sure.
thoughts for after public comment and we finish questions. So no, good thoughts, but we'll save that. I had a question regarding driveway turnarounds and turnouts. I read this says that driveways exceeding 150 feet in length but less than 800 shall have a turnout near the midpoint. And if the driveway exceeds 800 feet, turnouts shall be provided not more than 400 feet, which seems a little like a higher standard than the first part of the sentence. But my question is this, on a flag lot, like I have a flag lot, and it's 512 feet officially from the roadway to, you know, to where my property opens up, and it's 25 feet wide. It you know, it doesn't seem like there's room for a turnout on a lot of flag lots. And I think of some people who maybe have a curvy driveway that's hugging a hillside. How the heck are, you know, how wide does a turnout have to be? And how, I imagine there's got to be some circumstances where they just really can't have one.
Correct. We do have specific standards for the size of our turnouts. I don't have those in front of me, mm-hmm. but the code does say if your drive aisle or your driveway is 20 feet wide or more, then the turnouts could be exempt, because that's a fire access road width requirement is 20 feet wide. So if your driveway is 20 feet wide or more, then those turnouts are not required.
But I mean, some people have, I mean, ours is 25 feet with like a 12 foot, you know, driveway. And because it's kind of centered in a thing, there's really not room on one side or the other for a, you know, for a turnout. And I think some people have even more tighter space situations than we do. And I just know how they would physically accommodate a turnaround in the middle of a long flag you know, the pole part of a flag lot.
Yeah, there's also sections in the code that allow code modifications so that if it's physically impossible to do the to do those turnouts, they could actually submit a code modification, and it's up to the code official to either allow the normal driveway without turnouts.
Okay. So we recognize physical impossibility. That's a, yes. That's a good thing. Okay, very good. Thank you. And then here's a very quick question that you'll either know the answer or not. In the thing regarding the draft ordinance B, and it talks about, you know, our fire hazards and whatever, and it says that we have the potential for a collapsing freeway overpasses or a slide on both Cuesta and Ontario grades. Where in the hell is Ontario grade? I'm looking at fire or community development.
Yeah, or ordinance B is building code, so I'm gonna pass that one over to Bruce.
I've never heard of that, and if you, Mayor, if you could reference
on page 47 page? in about the middle of paragraph 2 on page 47. So it's just a curiosity. It doesn't really affect our deliberations. So that's your homework for if we take a break or at the end of the meeting, you can answer that question. Okay, I think that takes up my questions. Let's go see if we have public comment, and then we'll come back. Okay, yeah, the question regarding where the 75% comes from, I think in terms of who determines that, that's probably community development, but how do you determine that, especially given that, you know, by adding these requirements, a replacement cost is going to go up partly because of these requirements. And replacement cost is obviously going to be a lot more than somebody originally paid for the house. So can you address how the 75% is actually calculated?
Typically speaking, Mayor, thank you for your question. The 75% would be calculated from the licensed design professional. And the 75%, just so Council and Mayor, you're aware, that is currently in our Atascadero Municipal Code. It's currently is a provision that was established for when the value of proposed remodel, renovation, or repair work to an existing building exceeds 75% of the current valuation for a new building. That's when it'd be applicable. And the valuation with the conversation with the licensed design professional would only be applicable to things that would require a permit. So if you're doing addition and you're putting in new carpet and you're doing new flooring and new cabinets, well, those three items don't require a permit. So those would not be included in the evaluation.
Okay. And I assume this applies if your entire house burns down, you know, unrelated to a community-wide wildfire. Your house burns down and you have to rebuild the whole thing. That's automatically going to be greater than 75%.
Yes, that would be considered a new house.
And so this would, and which is interesting, though, because, I mean, even if you had, like, what you call replacement cost coverage with your insurance, you know, they're going to go, well, yeah, but now you're adding all these new features like sprinklers and this and that and the other. And so that would put some people in a bind from, you know, adding replacement costs that wasn't part of their coverage, I imagine.
It's very common when you get home insurance that it comes along with a provision that calls for building code and fire code upgrades. I know that when I got insurance for my home, it includes those provisions. Now you do have to pay for that provision, but it's not much.
Cost coverage would acknowledge that there's been changes.
Yes.
In
yes, most policies include that.
Got it. Thank you. We're going to go ahead and go out to community forum, see if any members of the public would like to comment on this item.
Good evening, Council. Jeff Oslin. Mr. St. James, do I have a Class A roof on my new buildings? Well, question.
Let's say that he'll answer that.
Well, it makes a big difference here, because if I don't have a Class A, that just adds more costs. If it's a Class A at this point on my project, then it does make sense. I don't believe it is a Class A. Secondly, going forward on this, if I tore my roof off my house and wanted to put a new roof on, would I have to go to a Class A in this new regulation? That makes a big difference in the other zone. I understand the red zone now would probably in building code require that. So I throw that out there. I'm going to give you, because both of these gentlemen have been out to inspect my project. If I wanted to build my project today, it would be $241,000 approximately more than it was 3 years ago to do this project. We adopted the WUI in May because the state mandated it. Before that, I think our building codes and our fire codes were pretty up to snuff, and we had the flexibility to do what we wanted to do in this city with our fire code and alterations in our building code to make things make sense. The problem I have with if we adopt this is the state's already come in and said, screw you, city of Atascadero and every other city in the state. This is what you're going to do. Now we're adding other costs to other people outside of it. And I have a big problem with that. Our council does speak about trying to keep things less expensive so people can actually live here, work here, maybe remodel their house, maybe build a new ADU. We already have stringent requirements, and the state could care less of what we do, so why are we going to make it any tougher? I have issue with that. No different than the roofs. I can tell you right now that if your roof is in crappy shape, your insurance company requires you to either coat it or pull it off and redo it. This goes on all the time, just like trimming trees and everything else. I have a 12-foot apron that I have to maintain between my trees and my house. If I violate that, my insurance is going to be canceled. I'm well aware of what the insurance companies do as well. They require a lot, and now we're asking for more stuff. I'm concerned about these new adoptions. I think they're good, but I also don't want the added increase on it. I believe on this, it's just going to add more dollars to people all the way through living in Atascadero. And lastly, on the garage door, I have the rubber things on my doors to prevent that, wind or whatever coming in. I don't believe ambers in a garage door being built today to code would make a difference. Most houses burn down from the vents, from the roof, and other areas. And your garage is going to melt from a fire, not an amber. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Any other member of the public wishing to speak on this item?
Chris Towers again. I just wanted to follow up on his comment about the vinyl stripping. I know for us, we put it on there just for temperature control. It's for part of the Title 24, right, to keep the thermal energy down. And I'm just sitting here thinking about an eighth of an inch metal gap, and we're talking, because garage doors don't come with that metal trim on the top. You're going to have to add that, unless there's a special Atascadero edition or something from the garage door manufacturer. But, you know, the engineer in me goes, I've got a standard two-car garage is about 16 feet wide. I'm made out of 24, 26-gauge sheet metal. Between 30 degrees at night and 110 during the day, thermal expansion on a piece of metal like that is an eighth of an inch. So I could almost make the argument that's going to cause more of a safety hazard, because if that metal expands, now your garage door is stuck and then you can't get out of your house, which is why, if you remember, we had to put all those battery backups in the garage doors so that during the event of loss of power, you could still get out of your garage. So I would make the case you're actually inducing more of a hazard, requiring an eighth of an inch metal gap at the top of it.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Okay, seeing no one else approach, I will bring it back to council, and I would comment that you see from the council questioning that the council does very much have concern about adding costs to folks. There is something we've learned through seeing some of these large scale fires is, requiring greater fire safety also, though, is for the entire neighborhood, so that, you know, your home is not essentially a source of fuel for spreading the fire in the neighborhood. Because I think fire folks would say that in some of these large fires, the homes become the fuel for spreading the fire, because you're in a neighborhood and things are going from house to house. It's the houses that are the fuel not, you know, not the trees, you know, and not the bushes, you know, maybe for an initial source, but when you're going house to house to house, it's the houses that become the fuel source, and having, you know, better protected homes is partly, you know, a responsibility we're putting on people, I suppose, to say, you know, don't let your home be the source of the whole, you know, the whole neighborhood burning down. I think, you know, we've expressed a great deal of concern. I think the question is, realistically, can we, are there any of these requirements that we could realistically lighten up on? Any of these local requirements? Because obviously we're stuck with what the state requires. It's not within our prerogative to do that. And the state, you know, says they're concerned about affordability of housing, but everything the state does makes housing more expensive. So whether it's, you know, fire or energy requirements or this, that. So I wouldn't pay attention to what they say on that, because they have demonstrated over and over again, they don't really care about the price of housing. But locally we do. And so the question is, are these local requirements, are, you know, are we comfortable with the additional costs, the trade-off between the additional costs they might impose, but the safety they provide for the, you know, for individual residents and for neighborhoods as a whole. So that's kind of like to lead off the discussion with council on. I see you have mic on, so we'll start on my right.
Thank you. I have a couple more questions. I know we're all concerned about fire dangers, but some of the things that I worry about is having earthquakes, and a lot of us don't have earthquake coverage because it's unaffordable, unattainable. So if we were to sustain in some of these older homes that are on raised foundations, a little bit of damage that ends up causing them to rebuild as well as pay out of pocket to do these additions they've always dreamed of, but then there's no insurance coverage. So now the cost to fix their home and live in that home is 3 to 4 times as much. One of the things I also concerned about is if we're requiring sprinklers in these remodels over 50%, because I believe once we modify that, we do also require fire sprinklers. Is that correct?
The modification for fire sprinklers already exists in our municipal code for additions over 50%.
Okay. So we already have that requirement. Thank you.
I was going to add, though, also that one of the other things that makes me a little more accepting of some of this is insurance companies are more and more driving some of these requirements anyway. I mean, you want fire insurance, they're going to want to insure you if you have a Class B roof, you know, that sort of thing. And it's gone from not just, you know, having discounts, if you will, for enhanced features like sprinklers, to now it's like, you know, they won't cover you if you have some of these conditions. So in that sense, I feel like we're, you know, we're imposing things that if we don't impose it, your insurance company is going to impose it in some circumstances. So, okay, I'll go, Councilmember.
I have one more thing to add.
Go ahead.
Fire insurance is not a given. The state does not, or locally, it's very, very challenging to get homeowners insurance. You can't even make a change to reduce your premiums without losing your policies. So a lot of people are foregoing insurance because they can't get it. A lot of people are not doing changes to their policies because they lose that coverage. So insurance companies can impose this, but some people are going without insurance. So having that replacement cost is out of pocket, which could bankrupt someone. If we're adding these additional local amendments that we have flexibility to kind of not make as unaffordable for anybody that's doing a small addition on a home that's already a really small square footage.
Councilmember Funk.
Yeah, the concern that the mayor and others have expressed is exactly why I pushed back against the request initially that all seven or eight or whatever of those new requirements be placed voluntarily by this council on everybody building a new property or substantial addition in the moderate fire zone areas. am I correct in understanding that we do not have the discretion about whether or not those apply in the fire high and very high fire zone risks, right?
Yes, that's correct. We don't have the discretion.
Okay, so the discretion is about the yellow thing, which is a substantial portion of the parcels of the community, of the build, of the built, of the at least the built parcels. that's where we have discretion, and so I continue to be concerned that if we're going to add additional requirements, they've got to have an important community benefit as well as just, you know, something that we think it would be really smart for you to do this. we can educate homeowners. Staff can educate homeowners on the value of doing all seven of those things, right?
Absolutely. And I might add, too, the long-term goal for our community is to become a fire-safe community. And all of those things, these provisions that we have worked on and tried to suggest, are getting us closer to being that fire-safe community. And that's extremely important to us because that would be a substantial reduction in insurance costs long-term for the community. I should also point out the other factor here, and I should have our fire marshal correct me if I'm wrong, but it's important to look at the current wild and urban interface too, which already has these requirements. And the difference between that map and that yellow zone area, it's not adding the 6,292, it's a different number. So a big portion of the city already has the requirements. Just the map is changing, the states change the maps, and we're responding to that. So the reality is the area that's going to require the new improvements is less than what you might see. And the long-term goal and purpose of doing it is really to help us get to a lower insurance cost and help us get closer in line with what the state's going to require anyway, and to help us be fire safe in this new era. So these are just things to consider. Mm-hmm. We have taken extreme caution in bringing these forward to you, knowing that there are increases to construction in cost.
Yeah, okay. So with those things in mind, I'm fairly comfortable that the much more limited list that came back this time of what you're asking the council to apply voluntarily are predominantly things that are either really small investments or are with huge payoffs, or they are like the Class A roof, something that is pretty universally happening anyway. So that I would be, you know, cautiously willing to go with that this time. And that's that, it, you know, withdrawing the objection that I raised earlier to applying any of this voluntarily, because, you know, we need to be cautious of the cost that it adds to housing, and give people as much choice as possible in what they take on their properties.
Okay, thank you. And before we proceed, though, I want to make sure we're on track of where we were. We had Fire Marshal go through his thing, and we had questions. We still have to go through the other section.
We still have a building code section to go through. So Bruce is anxiously awaiting telling you about that.
Back at council, we're not in motion mode or anything like that. So go ahead, Mayor Pro Tem.
Just a couple comments. Thank you, Mr. Dunsmore, for clarifying the potential increase in cost, which I don't believe that what anything we're doing is going to make a significant change in the cost of construction. It's the California Building Code that's pretty much doing that. And most of it's already industry standard anyway. With respect to earthquake insurance, I agree with what Councilmember Newsom said, although I would add that the best insurance policy at this point, if you have an older house that is not seismically stable, is to fix that. Go in there and do the seismic upgrades that are necessary. I lived through the Loma Prieta quake up in the Bay Area, probably 30 miles from the epicenter, in a house that was built in probably the 70s, maybe the 60s, and not even a window broke. Okay, so houses that failed, buildings that failed because they were on unstable ground, and that caused them to sink and crack and break open and all that kind of stuff. So houses that were seismically attached to the foundation generally didn't have much damage to them at all, from what I understand. So that's my recommendation on that. But anyway, so far, I think I'm good with everything that we've had so far. Thank you.
Any further comment? Okay, then let's go ahead and, I did have a question though, Mr. Dunsmore. You referred to Fire Safe Community. Did we not have a particular neighborhood in our city that became rated as a Fire Safe Community? Because Fire Safe Community doesn't necessarily apply to the entire city at large, correct? Or can it?
So we did have a specific community, Oak Ridge Estates, that became a FireWise recognized community through National Fire Protection Association. We have two more communities applying for that right now. But the state also recognizes a fire safe community, which is the whole entire city, that an application has to be made. We're waiting for our general plan update to make that application to become a fire safe community.
Okay.
They're two separate things.
Got it. Thank you for the clarification. Appreciate it. Okay, let's move on to the second aspect of this. I believe either Mr. Dunsmore or Mr. St. John will present this.
All right. Thank you, Mayor. Thank you, council members. We're going to jump into Ordinance B, Title 8. I'm going to grab that real fast. So what is Title 24? Just to clarify with everybody real fast for this evening, Title 24 is all of what you see there. And Mr. Dunsmore is gladly showing all those books that I brought that I read right before this meeting this evening. So I appreciate your patience. But Title 24 does include everything. This is what we're considering right now. It also includes, as Mr. Van Sunden spoke, the fire code and the California WUI code is in there as well. Some quick summaries or some short key changes overall. We're really excited about the building with the first ever the California WUI, because it is going to make it easier as the reference instead of going to multiple different books to kind of come to conclusions on structures. They're incorporated to one, which is great. But just to cover a couple more key changes, one of the other benefits, the California Building Code adopted consistent language with the California Health and Safety Code as it relates to swimming pools, spas, and hot tubs. That would be for both residential and commercial. Another good opportunity for the California Residential Code was the addition of a completely new section for sleeping lofts, which is going to allow for a little bit of flexibility for people that are looking to build smaller size structures and having some abilities to find flexibility in the code to create opportunities for additional sleeping areas. Some of the other more significant changes now, the California Residential Code requires that all utility connections go through the building department. Currently, right now, with the city of Atascadero, they have to get approval for the gas meter release and the electrical meter release. Now, the state is requiring that they also do the water connection. Some smaller stuff, electrical code, changes to some similar small things, arc fault breakers, new restrictions for energy storage systems, not necessarily restrictions on the systems themselves, but more protections to prevent accidents. Really minor stuff in the plumbing code and the mechanical code. But local amendments that are carrying over, we made some improvements with our off-grid for single-family residences, which would allow the not having the connection to the utility provider. That circumstance, when applicable, would be actually having the raceway or the conduit that would allow a future property owner to be able to connect to the utility company, but the current one can opt to not have the conductors installed so they can be off-grid. Tiny homes is something that's kind of advanced a little bit, and efficiency dwelling units. Some more flexibility in the code as it applies to the homes or single-family residences under 400 square feet. One of the things I would like to clarify that we kind of touched on again is one of the carryovers we talked about is the applicability for remodel, renovation, and repair to existing buildings. That is where that 75% cost evaluation comes into play. There are some provisions coming up in the that would be the existing building code and in an appendancy in the California Residential Code for existing residential units that might allow for some flexibility under certain circumstances or historical homes in nature. We can dive into that later if needed. Some new local amendments. There's a lot more appendices in the new provisions of the California Building Standard Commissions. mostly pertaining to the California building and the California residential code. I listed this year, we listed all of them in specifics with their topics, so it kind of gives you a better understanding that what we're going to do with them. Some more local amendments to the Tascadero Municipal Code provided a lot of clarification this year. We get a lot of questions in the building department, like, well, hey, how come this applied to this property but not to this property, or why are you enforcing this way? So we thought it was best to be consistent with most jurisdiction as they update their municipal codes during this time to provide a lot of the provisions of the code that people don't have necessarily access to, even though they are available online. But there's so many things that are online that might not be an accurate representation of the California building code or California residential code. So we took the opportunity to add those specifically so you guys all could take a peek at it, or members of the community can as well. But to jump in, just to kind of give you a little bit more of an example, really excited about this. So what we did is, this is Appendix P in the California building code, which references sleeping lofts. There's also an Appendix C in the California residential code that kind of adopts the same language, but it does provide allowance for and limitations on spaces intended to be used for sleeping lofts, the use of ship ladders for the means of egress, and then reduced guard height when the ceiling height is reduced. So that's one of the benefits right now of not necessarily reducing the provisions of the code, but providing flexibility for certain types of structures and certain sizes of structures. We are also going through the residential code. There's an appendix that was not previously adopted. It's BO, it's existing buildings and structures. This is encouraging the continued use or reuse of legally existing buildings and structures. While the new work would have to comply with the new code, the existing conditions can remain under the right circumstances or the right provisions of the code. We kind of touched on that a little bit earlier with a lot of the questions, but there are provisions for that currently with the California residential code. Off-grid is another big topic right now. We previously had provisions, but we're including them and kind of elaborating a little further. So single family residences without that electrical utility connection are required to have or should have the photovoltaic energy storage systems and backup generators. Amended sections of the International Property Maintenance Code. Here's a few amended sections to talk about unlawful acts, a list of what actually declares something to be unlawful or a public nuisance and violations of these codes or ordinances. Unsafe conditions. This helps provide clarity for myself and other staff members in the building department to make determinations when we consider a condition or a circumstance unsafe. And there's some additional information about sidewalks and driveways for property owners and the responsibility to remove hazardous conditions. Some of the benefits of some of what is mentioned up on the screen is the opportunity to provide, again, clarity for members of our community when we do have code enforcement opportunities or building inspections. We're trying to enforce provisions of the code. This will make it a little bit easier. It'll be a little readily accessible informationally. Post-disaster regulations. I know this topic was brought up a little bit earlier regarding earthquakes and our fires. There are certain repair there was a section that was added to our municipal code for repair criteria. This section will establish the criteria required to help support in any rebuild efforts due to damage that occurred during a locally declared disaster. We also included information on there as it relates to definitions to help provide support and clarity for some of the terms referenced in that provision of the municipal code. Some additional sections that were added that we're looking forward to get approval on. We took some of these provisions here. You'll see these are actually in all the books back there on that beautiful cart, but they were not in our municipal code. So if somebody had a question regarding scope and intent of the building code, but they were having trouble finding it, or they looked online and they found it, but they didn't realize they were looking at the state of Nevada, we've added these sections: conflicts between requirements, applications and permits, notices and orders. My favorite is inspections and inspection requests, because it's very difficult to get consistent information out to requestees for inspections. So we have that provision now that's been added to the municipal code. Permit expiration limitations and reactivating an expired permit. We provided additional clarity on that, which will make it more consistent for when people call the front counter, any department for that matter, or if you folks are asked a question, you can see in the municipal code what is the actual provisions that talk about permit expirations and reactivating expired permits, also location of permits and plans on job sites.
I know we have this recommendation slide here, but really what's supposed to be here is a question slide. So we're open now for your questions. That concludes our presentation from both building and fire. And but our final recommendation will be to introduce both the draft ordinance A to approve amendments to Title IV and introducing draft ordinance B, which improve the amendments to Title VIII Building Code and 2025 California Building Codes. Thank you.
Yeah, I feel like we'll have less questions on this part, but we'll see. I have a very quick question for you on page 60, and you mentioned this in the slides, but on page 60, it says the minimum size for a tiny house is not to be less than 300 square feet. And this stuff is applicable to things that are less than 400. So it's only applicable between 300 and 400. But it says it shall be noted that a tiny house is not an efficiency dwelling unit as defined in the building code. And you mentioned efficiency dwelling unit on the slides. What is an efficiency dwelling unit? And how does it differ from either a tiny house or a regular house?
Thank you, Mayor, for that question. I'm going to pull out a provision of the code real fast to read it for you. But in short, in the California Building Standard Commissions, what they allow is an efficiency dwelling unit is there's a restriction on what is the minimum required area or square feet for particular residents or occupants based on what is required for one person, two, three, or four people. So efficiency dwelling unit would be a residence that would be constructed when allowed that would not have more than two occupants. So it would start with 120 square foot minimum size for like the sleeping room with an additional 70 square feet for the inclusion of storage, bathroom, and kitchen facilities based on the architectural layout or design. So the difference between that is a tiny house with the requirements cannot be less than an efficiency dwelling unit, but doesn't have the actual occupant number that's restricted.
And it sounds like a tiny home can be between 300 and 400 square feet. So an efficiency dwelling unit can be even smaller based on what you described. So
go ahead.
I just didn't know what they were. Okay, thank you. I'll start on my left. Any questions?
Yeah, quick one. Thank you, Bruce. The maintenance, when you're talking about maintenance and the discretion on safety or maintenance, meaning just out and about town seeing something that's unsafe on someone's property, or is it, can you clarify what it means by maintenance as it pertains to your department?
Thank you, council member, for that question. I'm trying to go back right now when maintenance was referenced, and there were some provisions about sidewalks in the International Property Code as it relates to maintenance. So that's just the reference of the standard. So the International Maintenance or Property Maintenance Code is the California Health and Safety's code's way of enforcing substandard living conditions. So maintenance would be like if somebody failed to maintain a structure, so it became the structural components became dilapidated, or the structure was at a circumstance where it could fail during a seismic event, or if they didn't accurately maintain a water distribution system, so there wasn't adequate water to faucets or water closets or showers. So that's where the maintenance reference would come from.
I think when we were going over that slide, there was a comment on giving us a little bit more lenient.